Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Welcome, friend. It's July 19th, National Flight Attendant Safety Day. I'm not sure what that entails exactly, but be sure to leave them plenty of room when they pass down the aisle. A poor stewardess once bumped her ass against my hand. Luckily, no serious injuries. True story, Chester. Those old fly-to-friendly skies with Pan Am days are over. In any case, let's head inside. That's where I keep my smokes. That's better. Almost as nice as SimplyScaryPodcast.com. Did you know for as little as $5 a month, you can get their entire catalog dating back to 2012, ad-free and available to download or stream? Sign up as a patron today. And if you happen to pass by Patreon.com/DrewBlood on the way, well, pop in and say hi. All right, y'all, smoke 'em if you got 'em and drink those glasses to the bottom, 'cause your old pal Drew Blood has a tale to tell. And tonight, our tale comes courtesy of our very own Jeff Sturdivant. This one delves into a surrealized version of the Orient to explore the mysteries of exotic cuisine. So without further delay, from old cue ball head himself, I give you The Relativist. Who wouldn't love to work in a Chinese restaurant, if only for a day or two, just to see how they make all those delightful dishes? Most takeout places have the kitchen visible so you can see the silvery chamber and all its workings. Flames billowing from strange pipes, metal hoses, metallic tools, the whole scene is kind of steampunk, and little Chinese warriors back there trained in the art of Chinese cuisine, flipping the contents of their woks high in the air, chanting their exotic incantations. To all us non-Chinese, the delicious results are a wonder of the world. I refer to Chinese cuisine as the secret art because it really is the best-kept secret in the world of food. You'll never see anyone other than a Chinesian working in a Chinese restaurant, and most people agree that if you did, it would be strange. It's not a politically correct sentiment, but anyone honest will tell you Chinese cuisine is a cultural experience, and no one but a Chinesian can imbue a Chinese meal with that authentic Chinesey taste that makes it so special. We've all heard the tales of Chinese restaurants shut down because they refused to let in non-Chinese health and fire inspectors, and the ambitious American chefs who dedicated their lives to reverse engineering the dishes, yet produced only bland imitations. No amount of money has been sufficient to win a white man's entry into the Chinese kitchen either. It's simply too sacred an art, and the Chinese kitchen too sanctified an environment. So, with such exclusivity, all anyone could do was wonder how the Chinese really make Darth Balls, Both Floor, Smarful, and all those other magnificent dishes we tend to take for granted, and how they manage to manipulate their food in such a way that it takes on its unique characteristics. How to make a chicken taste like a monkey, a turtle like an apple, and so on. I've done plenty of speculation myself. That is, until the day I found my way into this crazy culture. The first Caucasian ever, I understand, to make his way into the mysterious Chinese kitchen. Me? I'm a short order cook by trade, My specialty is the omelet, which I've learned to prepare in such a way that its fluffiness is apt to astound. My secret? I'll never reveal it. This is precisely why I respect the secrecy of the Chinese. I understand the value in art's great mysteries. To reveal those sacred secrets to the unworthy could only scare the muses into hiding. It began at my favorite Chinese restaurant, Promiscuous Panda. The proprietor, Ben Quat, was gauging the satisfaction of the lunch patrons when I inadvertently pleased him by complimenting his shoes. They were orthopedic shoes, as most Chinese wear, but polished to a fantastic sheen. "Those shoes are really something," I said.
"Pardon?"
Ben said. "A quite fetching set of shoes. They suit you well." Now, the word fetching happens also to mean classy in Chinese. In China, a civilization organized by class differences, it was a high compliment to be called fetching. Ben's morale had been low that day, and my kind words were enough to lift him out of his funk. He had been perfectly primed for such a compliment.
"Thank you,"
Ben said. He smiled warmly at me. To those unfamiliar with a Chinese smile, it would have appeared that the lid of Ben's skull came unhinged, flipped open, and exposed his pulsing green brains. The Chinese smile is kind of funny. I'd heard plenty of Chinese jokes about how we smile too. They think it's awful strange how we reveal our teeth. As a relativist, I understand the humor from either side.
"They are orthopedic shoes,"
Ben said.
"Designed to prevent toe spraying. My arches tend to collapse from years of fast-paced work on slippery kitchen floors. After a while, the foot itself runs to pancake in all directions. This wonderful American innovation has saved me a great deal of dignity."
It pleased me to hear that Ben wasn't too proud to appreciate American ingenuity. Many Chinese shun practically everything American. "How are the orthopedic shoes in China?" I asked.
"There are none,"
he said.
"We're too proud of people to admit our orthopedic problems. We merely stumble around with collapsed arches and sprayed feet, pretending we are in no pain. This kind of pride, I find, is born of insecurity."
I nodded. Ben seemed like an open-minded individual, perhaps a relativist himself. "I can relate," I said. "I too am prone to this malady, if you'll forgive the pun, also being in the art."
"Aha, fine. That's good."
Referring to the culinary arts as the art is a secret handshake among chefs. Were I to describe myself as a cook or even a chef, he would not have continued to take me seriously. Real chefs are in the art.
"I'm always happy to meet others in the art,"
he said. His skull had closed, concealing his brain, but contentedly wobbled on its chitinous hinges. He politely examined my plate.
"And I'm happy to see you've decided to try the confounded shrimp. Tell me, what do you think?"
I hadn't tried one yet. I admit I'm a traditionalist when it comes to Chinese food. The confounded shrimp did look delicious, but here was my hang-up. There are no shrimp in China. Chicken, yes, or at least a very similar animal. Cows, yes, albeit twice the size. Fish, sure. They breathe air and fly, but in most respects, they certainly are fish. But there is no animal even remotely similar to shrimp. This made the dish a contemporary, and thus a controversial one. Not normally my thing. "I normally stick to traditional dishes," I said. "But they do look delicious."
"I too hold traditions in high regard,"
Ben said.
"But don't forget, all things were at one time new."
I tried a shrimp. Not surprisingly, it was as delicious as it looked. "Boogie woogie shrimpy wimpy flaniet," I said. Chinese, for this is the most tasty crustacean I've ever set teeth to. Ben lifted and dropped his penis on the table. A Chinese hats-off gesture.
New dishes are slow to gain acceptance. Shrimp is a new hobby of mine. I've been careful to treat them with all due respect to Taiping tradition. I'm glad you like it.
Although I've been calling Ben by name, I hadn't at this point known his name. And he hadn't known mine was Claude. I hadn't known my own name was Claude until 6 months earlier. I'd had it changed in order to sound more sophisticated to my peers in the art. It was for this reason, too, that I learned Chinese, by listening to instructional audio discs in my car. So we shook hands and he told me his name was Ben Quat, Ben for short. And with that, we became friends. Kiefler, in Ben's native tongue. For better or worse. 2. To name a Chinese restaurant, you need a noun and an adjective. Traditionally, a pot of fortune cookies filled with various nouns and adjectives are mixed together in a wok, out of which the proprietor and an honored employee select their cookies at random. On the fortunes are written words like jade, panda, wok, palace, kitchen, and so on. The resultant combination of a noun and adjective produced the name of the new restaurant. To ensure the success of the restaurant, the cookies are ceremonially consumed. The process sometimes yields unusual names. Some of my favorites have been Consummate Mollusk, Lugubrious Koala, Aromatic Beijing, and Gargantuan Palace, which ironically was a tiny hole-in-the-wall takeout joint. Most restaurants these days chicken out, so to speak, settling for names like Jade Garden, China Walk, etc. And when you run into a restaurant like this, you can be sure the food is just as much of a cop-out as the name is. Among practitioners of the art, they're regarded as hack joints. You most likely order from them once or twice a year with enough time in between to forget how unremarkable their food was and regard them as okay. I recall a restaurant in my youth named Golden Palace, set in a strip mall on a busy highway nearby my childhood home. It was anything but a palace. I remember dining on their grand opening. Neon lights proudly flashing, a sprawling fish tank full of Oscars greeting the diners on their way into the restaurant. The food was unremarkable. I was too polite to say so, of course, but this was telling. Food that doesn't warrant a remark is the worst food there is. You would have to criticize it incessantly before you had it deemed unremarkable. And sadly, that's what it was. The restaurant spoke for itself. Weeks later, three of the neon letters had burned out, leaving Old Palace. I knew the sign was never to be repaired. Inside, the Oscar swam in a foggy soup of unfiltered water. The food, and I'm not proud to have tried it again at this point, was purely abominable. Still, I couldn't help but pity them. They must not have eaten the cookies. One day, as I was leaving Promiscuous Panda with a takeout order of delighted beef, Ben said he wanted to show me a secret of the Orient. I was obliged, of course. While I watched, Ben produced one of the takeout boxes, those fold-up waxy containers with the metal wire handles. First, he folded the wire in a way that it was easily removed from the rest of the box. He set the wire aside and began unfolding it. As it turned out, the construction of the takeout container was something like origami, and it was fascinating to watch it done in reverse. When he had finished, I couldn't believe my eyes. A plate. The takeout container unfolded into its own plate. I was astonished. After perhaps thousands of takeout meals, I said. How did I never realize that? Ben smiled and urinated a little on my shoe. It was the first of many revelations to come. I was enjoying an appetizer one afternoon when he visited my table with a new experimental dish of his called Lucid Chicken. Like many Chinese dishes, the head was still present, and its expression represented the name of the meal. I gave the dish a half turn to admire the chicken's face. and I'll be damned if it didn't look just as lucid as a chicken could be. Great presentation, I said. I thought it would have been too forward to ask about the name. How they come up with these names is part of the mystery. As curious as I was, I didn't want to put him off by being nosy. The chicken watched me lucidly as I drew a bite into the hyperbaric phlernix, the traditional dining implement of the Chinese with which I'd become quite proficient over the years. I wouldn't be caught eating Chinese food with a fork the way the provincial do. Satisfied, I took a bite. Any chicken would be delighted to be done such justice at the table. The meat was so tender, it disintegrated with minimal mastication. It was just perfect.
The tenderness of the meat,
Ben said,
can only be attained through a truly lucid disposition. No amount of tenderization could replicate it.
I nodded. It was yet another clue to the secret art. One I would never have heard if I weren't Kiefler with Ben.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Ben sat down and we chatted over the rest of the chicken. Gratified as he was by his work, it was plain to see how tired he was as well. You can always tell a tired Chinesian by the way their antenna move, one just a bit ahead or behind the other, slightly out of sync, out of sorts. And it was no surprise Ben was tired. Running a restaurant isn't easy, and a Chinese restaurant may be the toughest type to run of all.
Once you've committed to Chinese restaurant,
he told me,
you've all but hung up your hat. All this, the ovens, stove, sink, grip quads, they're as permanent as the building itself.
He gestured widely around the shining steel fortress he'd built.
Moving to another location isn't feasible, not financially or practically. Even if you cared to spend the money it would take to change locations, most of the equipment would be ruined in the process.
Setting up shop is a pretty serious commitment then, I said. He nodded.
And that's just the basic cooking equipment. These strip mall restaurants are self-evident in their inauthenticity. It's simply impossible to create real Chinese food out in the open. Real Chinese food is created the same way real Chinese people are created. In private.
I had always known there was much more to Chinese cuisine than cooking alone. Let me be clear that as much as I hungered for the secrets of the Orient, I was not a friend to Ben for this purpose alone. I was truly a friend to Ben. But if he wanted to talk, I'd be more than happy to listen. 3. How did all this start for me? I suppose it was in college. We've all heard of ramen noodles. Those wavy bricks of dried pasta, almost impossible inexpensive, in the Asian section of the grocery store. They're considered a godsend for the poor and the hungry. Boil some water, add noodles, add mystery flavor packet, and voila! Lunch and dinner, sometimes breakfast as well, all for around 30 cents. It's inevitable that one will start experimenting with the noodles eventually, just to break up the monotonous meals. And with a little imagination, one will find many alternatives to their conventional preparation. Ramen noodle farfel, for instance, what I believe to be an invention of mine. Ramen noodle farfel is prepared like this. Parboil the noodles, strain well. Crack 3 large eggs in a bowl and add the flavor packet. Mix well. Add the noodles. Pour mixture into hot skillet. No salt necessary. The flavor packet packs the punch. Add cheese if desired, and enjoy. The impetus of the omelet, Whatever is available, unified with the egg as a kind of delicious coagulant, has always mystified me in its simple genius. They say genius isn't the act of making simple things complicated, but making complicated things simple. And that, to me, is this. The closest living ancestor of the Tyrannosaurus rex, the common chicken, reduced to a complacent flightless bird. Its eggs fertilized by our leftover morsels of food to give birth instead to a new meal. When one stops to think about it, it's beautiful. And when one adds cheese, it's breakfast. Autumn came, and so began Ben's seasonal use of root vegetables in his dishes. The traditional Chinese yarbubble, an orange radish the size of a Volkswagen, is replaced by the native carrot. Not only a suitable substitution, but a much more easily excavated vegetable. While I prefer the yarbubble, Ben steams a fine carrot.
Come,
he said one afternoon.
Let me show you something special.
To my surprise, he extended a hand toward the kitchen. He must have seen the self-consciousness in my expression. I'm not Chinese, I said.
You are Kiefler, a friend to the Chinese, a friend to the art.
I followed him through the kitchen door, keenly aware how rare an opportunity this was. I'd managed something practically unheard of in the world of the Caucasian. I'd become Kiefler. Kiefler to this kind man who was willing to overlook my race to make me feel welcome. Ben led me through the preparation area, Chinese cooks flipping food in hot woks. I recognized one dish as Pleasant Vegetable Volcano. When it was done being prepared, it would be garnished in the center by a lump of volcanic stone, pressed down into the pile of vegetables. The kids always wanted to keep the rock after the food was done. Now, the Chinese cook was browning the blorfs in their brothy juices, watching me suspiciously from behind a savory cloud of steam. At the rear of the kitchen, a Chinesian hunched over his deli slicer, pushing frozen chicken breasts over the whirring blade. Cold fillets tinked onto the wax paper like hard coins. Ben stopped to confer with the man and verify that the breasts were sliced in the proper direction, with, not against, the grain. This, I knew, was the secret to those rubbery slabs of chicken only seen in Chinese cuisine. The Chinesian acknowledged that he was indeed minding the grain. And it's a good thing, too. Ben would have fired him on the spot were he not. In China, a young cook not minding the grain was apt to be put on the slicer himself. Details are crucial in the art, and texture is an important one.
Come,
Ben said, and we went through the closet door into his little office. It looked like any other office, piles of paperwork on his desk, a small library of common cookbooks, stuff like that. He selected a key from his keychain and from a locker drawer produced a silk bundle, which he unwrapped to reveal a meat cleaver. You could tell at a glance that it was no common meat cleaver. It was ornately detailed, almost extravagant, and ancient. He handed it to me. It was heavier than I expected, but perfectly balanced. The handle was a dark green variegated wood with veins of yellow and brown. It was polished to a glassy sheen.
Regnum vitae,
Ben said.
The wood of life. Hard as steel. Very rare. It was once used to make ship bearings.
The blade was a sight to behold as well. The grain of steel repeatedly pounded and folded to produce the legendary hardness of a samurai sword. Just holding it, I could feel its power. Power to cut through anything, even inferior steel. What a knife, I said.
This is the cleaver of Hong Xiguang, a great chef and a great man. It dates back to the Qing Dynasty.
I've heard the name. How did you get it?
The knife was passed down through the generations, one chef to another.
Passed down? You mean you're related to Zhu Quan? He glowed with pride.
And as far as I know, the only one to keep sacred the Taiping tradition. So, the Kriva is mine. Sadly, with no one to pass it on to.
So few have held to the tradition.
So many fall to temptation. You see them behind counter at dirt cheap takeout joints. In the kitchen at Chinese buffets, frying chicken wings and French fries. And heaven forbid, things like General Tso's chicken.
He said General Tso with such vitriol. I knew it was a dish he personally refused to prepare. I knew there was something fundamentally offensive about it, but I didn't know what. Not yet. I handed the cleaver back to him, handle first. Hong Zhiquan, I said. That's incredible. He wielded the cleaver, working his fingers around the grip of the handle. His expression was reverent.
You'll know as well as I do, Claude, that mysteries exist for some important reasons. It's not important that you know anything more about Hong Zhiquan. Just know this. He was a man who was on our side.
4. Authenticity is a bone of contention in the Chinese food business. While some dishes resonate through the entire industry, even those differ substantially between the Americanized and the authentic restaurants. The Happy Family, for example, is one of the universal Chinese dishes you can find almost anywhere. It has a little of everything: shrimp, scallops, beef, pork, chicken, etc. A Happy Family. I know what you're thinking. Who exactly is supposed to be happy here? The scallops? These are sea creatures that would normally have nothing to do with each other, laying dead in the seared flesh of animals from an entirely different phylum. So whose family is happy? Well, yours, of course. The family holding the chopsticks. Unless, of course, you are adept at the hyperbaric flernix. Ben had a system, a traditional and secretive code he followed that was vital to the authentic cuisine he prepared. Understandably, he was guarded about it, but I had developed this sneaking suspicion through our correspondence that a lot of what he did was rooted in this ancient feud between the two aforementioned generals, Hong and So. I didn't know what it was, I didn't know what it meant, but all the modern issues of Chinese cuisine seemed to radiate from this ancient core conflict. You look exhausted, I said to Ben one afternoon.
I am,
he said, taking the seat across from me.
The struggle never ceases.
It wasn't the kitchen work he was referring to, I knew. It was the struggle to remain authentic. Competition was everywhere. Every strip mall in every town had a Chinese restaurant, each one offering the standard menu of popular dishes. Most set aside their cultural integrity to offer popular American variations of their coveted cuisine, drenching meat in glort and frap sauce, where no such things even exist in China. It wasn't the local adaptations I scoffed at, like the native chicken and shrimp, but the cheapening of the art you see so often, selling out entirely to the fat and salty American public. Ben seemed increasingly discouraged by the state of the Chinese food industry.
This period of profligatory consumption, in which the sanctity of our coveted cuisine is cast to the wayside,
as he described it,
people have become such inconsiderate eaters, barely tasting past the salt of any given dish. I suspect most no longer sense the spirit of their chef. In the past, the passion was pungent, as tangible to a diner as the most powerful seasoning. More powerful, even, than Old Bay seasoning.
The scales on Ben's arms Paolo erected to allow in more carbon dioxide. His antennae lay flat on his scalp, not unlike the ears of a suspicious cat. It was an expression I'd become familiar with over the weeks and months I'd spent talking to him. "The way things are going," I said, you may end up the only authentic Chinese restaurant left. Ben appeared to consider this. It was an exaggeration on my part, of course, but the immensity of the idea seemed to strike him on a visceral level. It's fairly easy to tell when you've struck a Chinesian on a visceral level. Their viscera itself will wobble, producing a rippling effect around the thorax. He sat up, regarding me with a curious look.
"Would you like to see something interesting?"
he asked. "Well, sure. Of course."
"Come on,"
he said, and he led me back into the kitchen.
"It goes without saying, I'm sure,"
said Ben,
"that what I'm about to show you must remain strictly between us. Between Kiefler."
"Absolutely," I said. It certainly did go without saying. He led me through the kitchen among the usual odd Chinese glares, flipping woks, and men at the slicer, minding the grain. Ben unlocked an inconspicuous door, and we descended down a staircase into the restaurant's basement. The room was lined with crates of restaurant supplies, styrofoam lunch special containers, paper takeout boxes, and soup containers. The floorboards above shook with the bustling kitchen staff. Ben pulled a shoestring and a light bulb illuminated crates and crates of those obscure Chinese vegetables. Those bamboo shoots, which I happen to know are rock-pounded yarfoid penises, and leeks, the testicles of the little-known cave tortoises of Yajing. While not a carefully kept secret, few people outside the yard are privy to these details, which I suspect is for the better. We walked through the rows of crates and boxes until I heard the trickle of water and saw a large aquarium against the far wall of the cellar. Upon closer inspection, I saw it was broiling with little shrimp. "Shrimp," I said.
"Watch this."
Ben unhooked a wire from the wall and began to feed it upward. From between the beams in the ceiling came down what looked like a disco ball, and he lowered it down over the tank and eventually into the water. The shrimp parted to make way for the ball. "Is that a disco ball?"
"Just wait,"
he said, and he flipped a switch on the tank which seemed to send the aerators into overdrive. Jets of bubbles poured into the tank, which sent the disco ball spinning. Ben fiddled around with some more controls, and multicolored lights illuminated the mirrored facets of the ball. And the introduction to Come On Eileen began to play muddily through a set of underwater speakers. I watched the shrimp as they danced. They swam in funny circles, bumping into each other. Some seemed to watch their whirling reflections in the spinning ball.
Why have I asked my HVAC guy I found on Angie.com to change my grandpa's trachea tube? Because I was so amazed by how quickly he replaced our air ducts. I knew I could trust him to change Pop-Pop's tube while I was on vacation.
Make it quick, young man.
Aw, see? Pop-Pop trusts you.
I think we should call a doctor.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
The shrimp are very confused.
So am I.
I expect so. But to understand the ethics, it's best you see it personally.
I looked at Ben. His face was sparkling in the light of the disco ball. What do you mean?
Philosophers of the ages have failed to agree on the treatment of animals. Immanuel Kant dismissed all animals as irrational beings. Any animal that cannot claim, I am, fails to meet his qualifications for moral consideration. While other philosophers, like Korksgaard, for example, have maintained that humans and animals alike qualify for moral considerations.
Right, I agreed.
We true traditionalists find harmony somewhere in between. These shrimp, I believe, can be prepared to eat in a truly ethical manner.
Ben turned a switch and I felt a waft of heat emanate from down below. He gestured for me to look, and I saw two burners down there, flames licking the floor of the tank. Above, the shrimp continued to dance in the spinning lights. A thermometer on the glass slowly began to rise.
Crustaceans seem to enjoy this song,
Ben said.
It's a guilty pleasure.
I watched amazedly as the shrimp danced themselves into the great beyond. I couldn't help but picture Hong Xiuquan standing there beside me. What would he have thought? I thought he would have been tickled green. He would have been proud. Proud of Ben. And I couldn't help but feel that pride myself. Hong Xiuquan would be proud that you have this cleaver.
Thank you,
Ben said. I could tell that he meant it. 5. Every culture's cuisine has its own particularities, some of which are delicious to every palate, and always those which require an acquired taste to enjoy. For those in the art, each have their own lessons to teach. In some parts of Africa, it isn't unusual to happen upon a meal of human meat, often prepared in bite-sized pieces on a skewer. A relativist myself, I steer clear of judging the ethics of other cultures' food preparation. Perhaps African people are delicious. Perhaps it's an acquired taste. The strange frozen people of the Arctic, who arrived thousands of years ago from outer space, have since discovered odd ways to consume our fish. They cover them in salt and bury them in the ground for months, until they are suitably ravaged by rancidification to eat. Likely this is an acquired taste. Beverages, too. Take the Russians' preferred beverage, vodka. Here in America, it comes in a bottle. Glass mostly, but plastic, flask-shaped bottles for those on the go. But in Russia, you can get your vodka in a pull-tab can. With this can, which is opened once and cannot be closed again, comes the implication that the entire amount of vodka therein is to be drank in a single sitting. Russians, of course, are made of a stiff cartilaginous material which needs to be constantly emulsified to enable movement. Also, they get very cranky. Our relationship with China is far more involved than our appropriation of their exotic cuisine. The Chinese discovered that they were able to hypnotize Americans with not only their food, but by the proliferation of little plastic things. Around our city ports, you can see the towering piles of shipping containers rustling away in shipyards, each painted with the indiscernible names of the Chinese export companies that feed our insatiable American profligacy. Thousands of metric tons of lead-tainted, poison-dyed, petroleum-based byproducts for our amusement. We give them to our children after a dentist appointment, load them into goodie bags after a birthday party, hide them in boxes of sugary cereal. We include one with every plasticine hamburger and fries in our popular restaurant chains. We collect them in the forms of little colored cats, dinosaurs, monsters, and superheroes. We load them into large plastic tubs with little signs that say bargain bin. They always seem to be coated in a micron-thin layer of strange grease, which, along with their conveniently small sizes, makes them irresistible for children to put in their mouths. Sexual deviants, I have often heard, sometimes screw them into their rectums, often requiring hospitalization. With modern technology, the Chinese were soon able to integrate basic electronics into their addictive little gadgets, and before long they became little robots. Plastic dinosaurs that roar, plastic cars that roll, tiny plastic radios that can pick up close-by transmissions, etc. In time, children found themselves uncompelled by any toy without batteries. Since the Chinese made these too, the system strengthened, and America's hypnosis with China continued to deepen. It's the equivalent of a fast-acting drug, a principle forged long ago in the Chinese opium dens, and applied now to both the food and little plastic things of everyday American life. It's an acquired taste. I'd been eating exclusively at Promiscuous Panda since the day I met Ben. The food was as good as Chinese food got. There was really no reason to go anywhere else. I began to wonder if I might have unacquired my taste for standard-issue American Chinese food altogether. It was the way Ben seemed so offended by General So's chicken that had brought the thought to the front of my mind. Having eaten only at Ben's restaurant for so many months, it had been a long time since I had ordered the dish. As I've said, Ben refuses to prepare it, and he'll have nothing to do with it. When it comes up in conversation, he is quick to change the subject, and now I found myself craving it. The dish is named after General So, a Qing Dynasty general. According to the Hunanese story, the general conceived the way to turn chicken into these magnificent, chewy little balls, but would not disclose his secret to anyone. The dish to this day remains largely a mystery. All we know for sure is that it is delicious. I felt a little guilty walking into Magnificent Walk to pick up my order that night. Like I was somehow cheating on my friend Ben, especially after all the privileged information he had entrusted to me. But I just had to have some General So's, and Magnificent Walk was known for theirs. Magnificent? Perhaps not that good. But when you're frying anything in a hot wok full of frap liver oil, you're sure to enjoy your dinner. I took my order to go. At home, I unfolded the takeout containers the way Ben had showed me. Proud of myself, I dug in. The chicken was indeed terrific, just like I'd remembered it, authentic Chinese or not. What was it about this General So's that was so offensive to Ben anyway? The sauce? The chicken itself? I just couldn't figure it out. By the time I had eaten half of it, a terrible idea crept into my mind. I sat staring at the remainder of the General So's, my curiosity in a battle with my sensibilities. It is unquestionably wrong to dissect a piece of General So's chicken, especially for someone in the art. It is beyond bad form. It's fundamentally offensive. If one were caught doing such a thing in a Chinese restaurant, he would be immediately ejected, his meal forfeit. Normally, such a notion would never cross my mind, yet here I sat, staring at the remainder of my food, suddenly desperate to delve deeper into this mystery in which I had no business meddling. My curiosity always gets the better of me. I dug out my old magnifying glass and a set of X-Acto knives. Sitting back at the table, I took a pointless look around the room to be sure I was alone. Of course I was, and with both excitement and embarrassment, I positioned the magnifying glass in its stand, selected a large piece, and looking through the glass, began to cut into it. What I found under the ripple and layers of fried batter didn't answer any of my questions, however, only baffled me further. Inside was not a simple chunk of meat the way you'd expect to see inside most dishes of the type, but in this case the word battered seemed to have dual meanings. It was twisted, contorted, tortured, frozen into strange attitudes. I'd never seen anything like it. Was this a certain part of the chicken? Did this have anything to do with the fact that Ben found it so offensive? I decided not to finish the remainder of my meal. I had lost my appetite, partially sickened with shame for what I had done, and partially put off by the look of the splayed-out specimen on the table in front of me. But it wasn't a knock on the food. Those single succulent bites of General So's chicken, those spongy spring-loaded bursts of meat, even in their cheap American excogitation, are difficult to disparage. Despite the look of it, you can't call it anything but delicious. Delicious it certainly was. But what else was it? 6. Ben invited me to attend Promiscuous Panda's anniversary celebration, their 5th year in business. Ben had closed the restaurant early and adorned the dining room with traditional Chinese decorations. Dozens of friends and fellow chefs in the art came to join in the festivities. It was an honor to be counted among them. A little awkward, granted, to be the only non-Chinesian in attendance, but my proficiency in the language served me well. After 3 or 4 rounds of Larfborg, the guests had sufficiently loosened up to put on some music. Traditional Chinese music is like nothing else, a style completely its own. If I had to compare it to anything, it would be a 2-cycle engine hooked up to a kind of baritone kazoo. Ben, who might have had a Larfborg or two before the party started, kicked off his orthopedic shoes and commenced to cut the rug. Several others joined him in a traditional Chinese dance. Chinese dances, like the music, are hard to compare to anything. Picture a freshly caught bluefish warping away on the floorboards of a boat. I made a brief attempt to join in, but quickly realized how silly I must look. Ben's skull was practically off its hinges. Later came the karaoke. Unfortunately for me, taco was not on the menu, only Chinese music. Ben, as was the custom, was the first to take the stage, and to drunken applause, began to fart out a tune. The Chinese sing kind of funny. I've heard them talk about how strangely we sing as well, from the same orifice we used to speak. So, as a relativist, I tried my best to fart along to the music. I didn't manage very well, but I think the Chinese partygoers appreciated the effort. A few hours into the evening, Ben indicated that he wanted to tell me something in private.
"You seem to have attracted the attention of a young lady,"
he said. "Have I done something wrong?"
"Not at all. Glorpeta, the young lady over there, she seemed to be rather interested in you."
Trying not to appear too obvious, I took a look. There she was, sitting by the condiment bar. A fairly attractive girl, at least I thought she was. Sometimes it's difficult to tell. Bright green scales, fairly symmetrical antenna, uncharacteristically good arches.
"How do you know she's interested in me?"
"Chinese chefs make especially good use of body language to communicate in the kitchen. Over sizzling woks and through billowing steam, the staff must communicate by many method. Glorpeta's body language I can read as clearly as any recipe. And this recipe, I suspect, is passion."
"Are you sure?"
Ben made a heart with his antenna.
"Positive. Talk to her. You'll see for yourself."
Submitting to Ben's urges, I introduced myself to Glorpeta and joined her near the condiment bar. She was a kitchen worker at the Saucy Partridge, she explained, a Chinese buffet several towns over. I was familiar with the place. It had been a while since I'd dined there, but I still remembered the delicious dumplings and the ornamentally etched sneeze guards on the front blorf bar. While the party raged on, Glorpeta and I talked easily about the art, particularly the subtleties of Chinese cuisine. Her skull stood on end as I described my experience with Ben's most recent chicken innovation.
"Ben is a true craftsman," I said.
"He is. Very, very crafty man. You two are good friends?"
"Certified Kiefler. I've been in the kitchen."
"Really? You must be a really, really nice guy."
"Well, I don't want to brag or anything, but I was voted most likely to be a really, really nice guy in my high school yearbook."
Gorpetta's nostrils unraveled so far she almost knocked over her drink. The Chinese laugh kind of funny. To be fair, they think we laugh funny too. Glorpeta had come to the party alone. After talking for a while, I got the idea she was lonely. Probably tired of being cooped up in the kitchen for such long hours. I also got the idea she was curious about non-Chinesian men. She seemed to be enthralled by me. My smooth skin as she stroked my hand. My hair. My unabashed, tooth-revealing smile. I started to think maybe Ben's intuition had been accurate after all.
As though he sensed my thought just then, Ben caught my eye from across the room and motioned that I come over for a minute. I excused myself from Glorpetta and went to talk to him.
"Have you ever made love to a Chinese woman?"
Ben asked. "What? Have I? No. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that. I just..."
"Just listen."
Into my ear, Ben whispered secrets of the Orient I had never even thought to explore. Not of the art this time, but another art entirely. The art of love. Maybe a minute of this, and he patted me on the back, indicating he was done. "That's some pretty wild stuff."
"May it serve you well."
It was only a matter of time before we found ourselves back at Glorpetta's apartment. Naturally, I was trepidatious. This was something completely new to me. I knew basically what to do. Ben had given me a decent crash course, but that was like someone telling you how to roller skate. The only real way to learn was to do it. I knew this much. The Chinese penis is rather enormous, roughly the size of an arm, bent in the middle at 45 degrees, and tipped with an apparatus like a medieval morning star. Obviously, I was ill-equipped for the job to follow, at least in the customary sense of things. But what I did have was an arm, and as Ben had explained, I could certainly bend it at 45 degrees. Now, anyone who knows me will tell you, I always tell the truth, and I never exaggerate. So when I tell you her scales were as smooth as a Komodo dragon's, you can believe every sultry detail. For the sake of tastefulness, I won't describe the act that followed. Only her winding scaly gyrations, powerful and snake-like. Her soft breath, hot and acrid as the Venusian atmosphere. The pheromone-laden secretions of her freshened loins. The pervasive fragrance of microwave popcorn, burnt bacon, and the lotus flower. We lay together afterwards, the post-coital bond embracing us in an ethereal mist. I wasn't satisfied in the conventional sense, but fulfilled in a deeper way, a more cultural satisfaction. Such exotic experiences are the relativist's mightiest pleasure, and as things would turn out, this one was an essential ingredient of my journey into the world of the Orient. She lay cradled in my left arm while my right arm lay stiffly in the sheets beside me.
"I have never done that before,"
she said. "Would you call it a relative pleasure?"
"Huh?"
"I mean, was it good?" She grinned mischievously.
"Certainly,"
she said.
"And you've satisfied a great curiosity of mine."
"I was curious too. I have many curiosities."
"Do you?"
She turned to face me. Her eyes were starry in the moonlight through the window.
"What else are you curious about?"
"What can you tell me about General So's chicken?" She seemed confused. I admit it was a bit of a departure from the romance of the moment.
"What about it?"
she asked. "I'm not exactly sure. It's like there's something weird about it. Something no one wants to talk about." She seemed to consider her answer for a moment.
"For those who hold sacred the tradition? For those who hold sacred the art? The general has no part."
She appeared uncomfortable as she spoke. I almost told her to stop, that I was sorry I asked, but my curiosity kept me quiet.
"All I can really tell you is this. There are limits to what we are willing to accept, no matter how open we claim to be. There are sacred things. There are abominations. Without both of these things, we cannot fully be human. And the general dwells within the realm of the latter."
We lay silent for a while. I couldn't convince myself to delve any further into it, especially with the way my question had disturbed her so much. But naturally, my curiosity was only kindled. I think it was Confucius that said, "The satisfaction of the seeker is more ephemeral than a Larfborg buzz." 7. Armed with my proficiency in Chinese and my new insights into the art, I decided I needed to learn more about not only Hong Xiuquan, but hopefully General So, and his mysteriously antagonistic dish. To do so, I knew, I needed to delve into the past. There were only 3 Chinese libraries in the continental United States, the closest being in nearby Bethesda, Maryland, birthplace of Daniel Stern. I arrived at the Chinese sector of Bethesda amid countless suspicious eyes one sunny Monday afternoon. There were no laws against non-Chinese people being here, only the prohibitory glances from the locals to discourage them. Ignoring the looks, I made my way toward the Chinese library in the center of the Chinese quarter. If there was anywhere I could find the answers I was looking for, I knew it was here. Inside the library, I felt like something of a spectacle, the locals all glaring hard as I passed by. Most stayed quiet, but some made their comments, incorrectly assuming that I didn't understand Chinese. Things like, "What in the world is he doing here?" and "Someone ought to show that man the door." And "Look at his perfectly perched arches." None of this did I take personally. Walking slowly, I scanned the spines of thick volumes in the shelves of the library's reference section. One caught my eye, a book entitled King Kong to Hong Kong, and I pulled it from the shelf. Perusing the pages, it wasn't long before I caught a reference to General So. I looked up and down the aisle to be sure I was alone. Reading further, I came to find that the general's full name was not So, but Sung Tang. The text made only brief reference to the dish that was named for him, but said something peculiar about it. Here's what it said. "General So's chicken was perhaps Sung Tang's most notable incantation. Not his most notable conception, not his most notable creation, his most notable incantation." The words conception and incantation are similar in Chinese, and I didn't notice the difference at once, only that there was something slightly unusual about that particular paragraph. But when I opened up my English to Chinese dictionary to check, I realized what I had initially overlooked. I followed a citation on the same page to the back of the book, where I found the title of another book entitled Summons of the Orient, which I soon located in the same aisle. It was in this book, an ancient-looking leather-bound tome, that my walk into the mysteries of Chinese cuisine found solid footing, beginning with the lore of the mysterious Sung Tang. The Taiping Rebellion, I read in the text, was a war against the ruling Qing dynasty, led by none other than Hong Xiuquan, a Hakka Chinesian and Christian, who believed himself to be the younger brother of Jesus Christ. He led the rebels who called themselves the Heavenly Kingdom of Transcendent Peace in a war that lasted 14 years and resulted in roughly 20 million casualties. Hardly peaceful at all, I thought. General Sung Tang, high-ranking noble and military strategist of the ruling Qing dynasty, led his army to stifle the rebellion. Sung Tang was reputed to belong to a secret Chinese society, translated in English as the Bloods of the Lineage. Though little was known about the elusive and exclusive cult, it was suspected by its symbology to involve the practice of an unusual Chinese brand of witchcraft. During the Long War, when rations became scarce, he was said to have performed unorthodox rituals to feed hungry Qing Dynasty soldiers. Stories followed, some inventive of the biblical tale of manna falling from heaven. In these stories, however, the manna was said to seep from the ground like blood. A quote of General Sung Tang from the text seemed to add credence to Hong Xiuquan's godly claim,
fundamentally opposing force. Hong Jiquan, began General So's quote in Chinese, will soon find himself at the left hand of God. It was all the information I could find. No books that dealt directly with the subject, only occasional references to Sung Tang and his chicken dish, and no other references at all to the bloods of the lineage. After a Chinese lunch of dumplings and schmarf, I went back out to walk the streets of the Chinese Quarter. The locals all left me a wide berth, making their comments and keeping their distance on splayed feet, antenna suspiciously twitching. I approached the newspaper stand where the man inside the small hut had no real way to avoid me. I spoke to him in Chinese. "Sir, do you have any maps of town?" He turned to a display of magazines and newspapers and rooted out a pamphlet and handed it to me. "Chinatown Bethesda," it said.
"Favadora," he said.
Resentfully, I handed him the money. I figured he had added a Caucasian surcharge. Back at my motel, I searched online for information about the bloods of the lineage, on which there was surprisingly little. What I did find largely echoed the information I'd read in the library. A secret society about which very little was known. It looked like I'd reached a dead end until, on a whim, I clicked on Google Images and scrolled down a bit through the seemingly unrelated pictures. One picture got my attention. A seal. An encircled pentacle picturing a winged figure within, holding a skull in the talons of its feet. A rib cage in its left hand and a long bone in its right. Maybe a leg bone. I sat upright and clicked the image, entitled Seal of the Bloods, taking me to the site on which it was located. Unfortunately, the image was only a vestige of an abandoned domain. My luck. I sighed, looking for clues on the webpage but finding nothing. It was getting late and I wanted to go to bed. Frustrated, I closed the laptop and lay back on my pillow. It was only as I was slipping off to sleep that an idea shook me awake. I sat up and turned on my computer. Selecting the long web address at the top of my browser, I scrolled all the way to the end. There, after the forward slash, was my clue. Just the way I'd imagined it while I was drifting off to sleep. "I can't believe it!" I said out loud. It read, Bethesda_Depot. I still have the fortune from my first fortune cookie. I carry it in my wallet. It says, always search for the truth. Not much of a fortune, I know. More of a piece of good advice. It's a piece of advice I can't help but follow to this day. Sometimes it's probably a better idea to be content with the truth that you know. In time, truth has a tendency to reveal itself. Bethesda Depot was a plain block building with the Bloods of the Lineage insignia painted discreetly on the bare metal door, barred windows, several smatters of graffiti by the sidewalk. A procession of unmarked box trucks, also laced with graffiti, drove along the side of the building and west down Broadway. I stood by a nearby phone booth and watched the front door from the corner of my eye, waiting for it to open. Eventually, it did. A small, well-dressed Chinese fellow with a briefcase hopped out and started up the street. I fiddled with the phone as if it had eaten my quarter, then hung up and followed him towards the square, making sure to leave a safe distance in between. You might be wondering, what was I thinking at the moment? The truth was, I didn't exactly know. I didn't know what I meant to do either. I was just watching, following the man. I wanted to see what he was up to. Turns out he was hungry. I followed him into a dumpling joint and waited behind him in line with another 5 or 6 Chinesians. Standing close to him now, I saw the Bloods of the Lineage insignia was embossed in the leather of his briefcase. The smell of steamed cabbage and fried yarbubble actually made my stomach rumble, but it wasn't dumplings I was interested in. I was interested in what might be in the man's briefcase. He approached the counter and ordered in Chinese, 12 yar buble dumplings, I heard. And when it was time to pay, he set the briefcase on the ground. My heart jumped. For a moment, I just looked at it. It was now or never, I thought. If I was going to do it, it would have to be now. I didn't give it another thought. I just grabbed the briefcase and ran. I heard shouts of exasperation behind me as I pushed through the door, but did not look back. And I was out on the street and running like my life depended on it. I headed west up Broadway, turning down a stinking alley and launched myself up onto a dumpster and up and over a fence. Several cats scattered from around the leaky bag as I slalomed through the garbage. Finally, I came out on Washington Avenue near the corner of Wilkes. I walked now, trying not to appear suspicious. But as I neared the subway station, I felt a strong hand grasp my arm.
Stop!
The grip was like iron. I wasn't going anywhere. I turned to see a short, muscular Chinesian. His antennae were splayed back and his eyebrow had turned into a kind of asterisk, signifying dire seriousness.
I don't know what you want with that case,
he said in perfect English.
But you don't know what you're getting yourself into.
He snatched the briefcase with a strong hand and yanked, easily breaking my grasp. But in the process, the clasp released and the case fell open. Quickly, I grabbed for the fallen papers and got hold of a few of them.
You don't know what you're getting yourself into,
said the Chinesian. But I was already on my way down the stairs and into the crowded subway station. 8. The language barrier between us and China can result in some bizarre exchanges, but as far as wordplay humor, Ben manages comfortably.
Have you ever seen an egg roll?
He asked me. Sure, I said. Why?
Watch your step.
I laughed politely. Ben, I have to ask you something. I don't want to put you on the spot.
We are Kiefler.
I know, I know. I took the paper out of my pocket and unfolded it on the table. He looked down at it. He was silent for a moment.
Where did you find this?
It's not important.
It is important,
he snapped. Even though I never pushed Ben to share secrets with me, the truth was always lingering in the air. He knew it as well as I did. I was passionate about what he did, passionate about true Chinese cuisine, and I wanted badly to know its real secrets.
Claude,
he said,
you're going to get yourself into trouble. Maybe worse.
I understand if you don't want to help me. I really do, and that's fine. I just thought you might be able to tell me a little about this insignia.
Why are you doing this? You really want to pursue this? You want to know that badly?
I paused. More than anything in the world, I said. He knew I meant it. He sat down and sighed. He was quiet for a while he thought about it.
Okay, listen,
he said.
Meet me here at 11 p.m. We talk about it. I offer this for your own safety, to satisfy your curiosity. But park in the rear of the building. Do not let anyone see you.
Thank you.
We are Kiefler. I never thought it was possible for different races of people to become Kiefler. But it's true.
Ben presented his penis and I shook it. We were indeed Kiefler. And tonight, he'd grant me more of the knowledge I craved so deeply. Still, his expression was uneasy.
Claude,
he said,
just remember, always remember, only a fool would endeavor to fight a losing battle. A battle that could not be won by thousands cannot be won by any one man.
I nodded. I fully understood that so many had tried before me, and there were reasons non-Chinese chefs were not allowed into the secretive Chinese kitchens.
good reasons. And I respected those reasons. But I didn't mean to hijack the secrets of the Orient, or attempt to practice them myself. When I wanted to learn, I wanted to learn out of genuine appreciation, out of reverence, and never in any sense of the word by means of a battle. But the desire was simply too strong to just give up and not continue to pursue. Like the red words on that little shred of paper in my wallet told me, I was always to seek the truth, and I had to. It was my fortune. I drove around back of the restaurant with my lights off and parked. There was Ben's Honda. He had waited for me as promised, but as I approached the door, something seemed strange. The lights were on inside, and I saw the spider-cracked glass of the back window. I stopped at the door. Ben? There was no answer. I tried the door and it opened. Pots and pans were scattered. A sack of rice lay on its side with its contents spilled all over the floor. Ben? I looked around the corner toward Ben's office. That's when I saw the green smears of blood. No, I said. How could this be happening? But I felt that sinking sensation in my stomach the moment I thought it. Because in the darker recesses of my mind, I already knew. There he was, in his chair, slumped over his desktop. Blood everywhere. Purchase orders scattered across the desk and on the floor. As I approached, what I saw there on the desktop confirmed my fears. It was the insignia of the Bloods of the Lineage, drawn in green blood. No, not you, Ben, of all people. The perpetrators were gone. I knew that already. Like ninjas, they'd snuck in, eliminated their perceived threat, and escaped. And here I knelt, alone with my grief. My friend. My Kiefler. The only Chinese ever to trust me with the secrets of the Orient. Gone. Ben, I hardly knew you. My Kiefler. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I shed more than a tear there in Ben's office. Many tears were shed. But once I was able to get a hold of myself, my resolve was renewed. I didn't know how they figured out that Ben was leaking information. Had I been trailed today? Had they been watching him in the first place? Whatever it was, this wasn't the last of it. Because now, I was coming after them. 9. I made my way through the rain and the dark back to the Bloods of the Lineage building. Ducking around corners and behind dumpsters into alleys not to be seen. I didn't know what I was doing, only where I was going. To seek revenge for Ben's murder? To find answers? All I knew was that I had to do it. And this time I was armed, with Ben's big cleaver. I approached the building from the rear this time. Peering from behind the dumpster of a nearby building, I saw the box trucks and black SUVs parked in the safety of the parking lot, several Chinesians walking inside. I saw the loading dock, sealed under the sliding steel doors. The fire escape, rusty rebar crawling up the brick walls, denied by the barred windows. On the bottom, a solid-looking metal door. I worked my way closer, all the while ready to dash for cover at the slightest sign of notice. Before long, I was on property, squatting by the retaining wall, trying still to decide exactly what I meant to do. Was I really going to avenge the death of my friend? Had I lost my mind? I didn't really know. Was it because I felt at least in part responsible for what had happened to my friend? Perhaps. I was following my instincts. This curious momentum driven by my own dissonance. The same force that had gotten me into this in the first place. Was I doing the right thing? Who's to say what the right thing even is? I took a last look around to make sure no one was watching me. I was alone. Quietly, I turned the knob and snuck inside. A long corridor lined with doors. The air was thick with the smell of hot peanut oil. I tiptoed down the hall, peeking through the small glass windows in each door. This time of night, I figured it would be quiet, and it was. There was no sign of anything going on, but I could sense that I was getting warmer. Literally warmer, as the cleaver of Hong warmed against my side in verification I was on the right course. Making a right at the end of the hall, the cleaver seemed to vibrate with urgency. There was a set of double doors nearby, the left one still gently closing. Red light glowing faintly somewhere beyond. I went inside. It looked like the backstage area of a theater. Walkways to the left and to the right. In front of me, scaffolding leading high up into the ceiling. Murmuring din beyond, a dozen or more Chinesians chatting in a muffled tone. I listened carefully but could not make out any of it. If I walked either left or right, at some point I'd be right out in the open. I was sure to be spotted. I decided to climb the scaffolding. 30 feet above, I peered down at the scene below. It was like looking down at a stage. A stage, but more like an altar. In the center was a wide, shallow pit brimming with, of all things, softly clucking chickens. The Chinesians I had seen coming inside were now dressed in dark, ceremonial-looking robes. Suddenly, they all grew quiet. A dire sensation hung in the air. Something serious was about to happen. The robed Chinesians stood about the altar in a semicircle while another, this one dressed in a particularly ornate robe, gestured over what appeared to be a large wok. He began to chant then, some kind of strange incantation. Whatever language he spoke only vaguely resembled the Chinese I knew. The pit of writhing poultry tumbled over each other, waving their wings and clucking. The air seemed to grow colder. The stone walls began to glow, a strange iridescence echoing back the charms of the chanting man. The priest, I figured. Perhaps the high priest. But the high priest of what? The Bethesda Depot? The Bloods of the Lineage? My mind had wandered away from Ben. Something in the atmosphere had overridden everything. The anger, the vengeance, all of that. It was my insatiable curiosity, my deep desire of the secrets of the Orient that overrode it. And while the priest chanted his spell over the pit of chickens, I was overwhelmed by the gravity of it all. The thousands of years of tradition unfolding before me.
"General of Fire," chanted the priest. "General of Destruction. General of Delicious Chicken. Bring forth your fire."
The congregation murmured the incantation in unison. Then, while I watched, bright red light began to glow through the fittings of the tiles of the floor. The chamber vibrated with a low rumble. The pen of chickens boiled with fear and feathers.
"Bring forth your fire!"
The blocks of the floor began to fall away one by one. The holes they left behind issued boiling red light into the room. My eyes squeezed shut against the intensity. The priest bellowed a final time.
"General of Delicious Chicken!"
More blocks tumbled away into the roaring inferno below. A rising pool of lava sent the temperature soaring to unthinkable levels. I could feel the hairs on my face and body curling against the heat. What had this priest done? Something began to rise from the pool of lava. A human-shaped figure. Amazingly, it appeared to be moving. The figure of a warrior clad in King Dynasty era armor. This general the priest had somehow summoned. A supernatural effigy of sorts. But not an effigy at all. It was moving. Living. It was a moment before I realized just who this general must be. This general of fire the priest spoke of. This general of delicious chicken. It was the general. General So! He stood resplendent before the congregation in the writhing pen of chickens. To be a chicken before General So, I thought. The horror. The humanity. The chickenity. I felt a strange vibration against my chest. I pulled open my jacket and saw Ben's cleaver glowing faintly blue. It resonated with some sort of diametric spirit, at odds with this oppositional force in the room. The very nemesis of the bloods of its own lineage, the warriors of the Taiping Rebellion. The specter of So uttered something unintelligible, a dirge of hellish babble, then bellowed a gout of white-hot fire, engulfing the pen of chickens. Instantly, the iron bars of the pen glowed white with heat. Inside was a whirling firestorm of poultry. The chickens panicked, colliding into one another, running in circles while their plumage disintegrated into blazing motes. The stench of burning feathers filled the chamber. When the flames receded, they left behind a frenzy of bald and frantic chickens. The fire seemed only to affect their feathers. How could this be? It wasn't over. The ghostly general raised his arms. From the pit below clawed a dozen little creatures, demonic little creatures. Humanoid forms glowing like smoldering coals, crawling on all fours. They slithered along the stone floor toward the chicken pen, then up and over the iron bars. The cleaver vibrated despondently in my jacket as though enraged, as though it were begging me to intervene. But what could I possibly do? Just before dropping into the mass of chickens, one of the little demons turned and looked right in my direction. Its eyes were bright orange spots. I saw in its tiny grin a row of piranha-like teeth. For a mere millisecond, we locked eyes. Then it turned away and dove into the pen. They bit the chickens, spit out chunks, teased them with jabs of their claws. Chickens fell to pieces with a cacophony of clucking. The floor was strewn with hunks of flesh and meatless chicken carcasses, swimming with blood. This went on for minutes. Satiated, the demons withdrew from the pen. One after another, they went headfirst back into the hole and back into the depths. The congregation watched reverently, beads of perspiration dripping from their faces. The general wasn't through. It breathed another gout of fire, this one bright red and hottest of all. Even high above the rafters, the heat was close to overtaking me. The meat in the pit below sizzled, twisting and shrinking into sizzling, blistering little nuggets. Clouds of steam billowed up to the rafters, carrying the rich scent of cooking meat. The smell was unmistakable. General So's chicken. Helplessly and disgusted at myself for it, I began to salivate. The heat finally receded. The worshippers bowed low before the floating demon. The priest reached into a satchel and ceremoniously scattered a handful of something onto the smoking pile of meat. Though I was too far above to see it, I knew what it was. Sesame seeds. With this, the general began his descent back down into the fiery abyss. The congregation remained bowed as it returned to wherever it came from. I had a pretty good idea just where that was. And if the heavenly kingdom of transcendent peace were still in existence today, I think they would have agreed with me. When the demon had gone, the blocks rose again to reassemble the temple floor. Before long, it was as though nothing had happened. The Chinesians entered the pen with spatula-like tools to pry up and collect the sizzling morsels of General So's chicken. as fresh as they come. I crouched motionlessly on the rafters until the congregation finished and left the temple. Had I come here for revenge? Had I come here for answers? I'd just borne witness to what no non-Chinese man, in the art or not, was ever supposed to see. A ceremony Ben had shunned, same as General Hong had, and the Heavenly Kingdom of Transcendent Peace had. Was this revenge enough? Or had I chickened out, so to speak? Something in the cleaver, whatever force it contained, provided me right then with my answer. It filled me with a sense of easiness for the moment, of pacifism. There had been enough fighting, enough warring during the Taiping Rebellion to satisfy both forces 100-fold. Whatever force I had witnessed tonight, and the resistance whose spirit dwelled in the blade, and now in me. Maybe there were some bits of this secretive culture I was better off not knowing after all. How they make General So's chicken, for one. I could certainly leave this one out of my repertoire. I understood now why Ben refused to even speak about dishes like these. These were the dishes of the dynasty. In the matter of the Taiping Rebellion, I thought it was clear now which side was righteous and which side danced with the demons. And I, imbued with Ben's secret knowledge and the spirit of the cleaver he had passed down to me, was no part of the latter. Relative as it all may be, sometimes choosing a side feels more like the side chooses you. 10. I visited a Mexican takeout place one day, a place called Taco Garden. Inside, I saw the place had been modeled on a typical Chinese takeout template. A couple of tables, the front counter, complete with the backlit display of notable dishes, the rice-filled cup holding a few pins, and the formal numbered menus. An open view of the kitchen behind, complete with the tireless Chinese workers. The only thing not obviously Chinese was a simple sombrero hanging on the wall. I asked the Chinese lady at the counter, "Was this once a Chinese restaurant?"
"No,"
she said. "Oh," I said, "because the whole setup, the menus, everything, it looks just like it would in a Chinese restaurant."
"No,"
she said. I thought about it for a moment. Certainly, they would attract more attention as a Mexican restaurant if they set the place up to look like one, wouldn't they? "All right. I was just wondering why it looks so much like a Chinese restaurant."
"Because we're Chinese."
Ethics are relative, I've heard countless times, and as an ethical relativist of sorts, I've always tried my best to agree. Only lately, I've begun to seem less genuine to myself in these matters. I've begun to distrust my own motives. I don't remember when it was exactly that I started to wonder about sacred things and where they fit into this code of ethics. Those things that, in order to be inherently sacred as they are, exist in a kind of parallel dimension alongside the sliding scale of ethical relativism. A kind of magnet hiding under the table. What are sacred things and where are their place in ethics? Culinary ethics vary widely among cultures. I've read at length about China's periodic dog festivals in which they torture, kill, and eat dogs, animals my country happens to have a great fondness for. When asked, each opposing side presents valid arguments on their ethical standpoint. Proponents think that dogs are no better than any of our other animals, therefore are perfectly suitable to be used as food. Americans, however, find this loathsome. Our dogs are our family members. Eating one is practically cannibalism. Pigs, on the other hand, although they're at least as intelligent as our dogs, and so similar to us genetically that we can transplant their heart valves into ours, are as good as bacon. Now, if a dog eater asked me why pigs are good to eat and dogs aren't, I'd be hard-pressed for a reasonable answer. All I think I could come up with is the fact that dogs to us are family, and family is sacred. Take cows. Whatever your position on this sliding scale of ethics, from those in India who worship them, to those in the American Midwest who depend on them for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, where do sacred things come into play? If the divinity of the cow, which is held sacred, the scale is tilted irrevocably in their direction, beyond whatever could be considered a logical compromise. The cow is sacred. If it is the American birthright of unlimited beef which is held sacred, the scale is tilted towards the heartland. My answer to this one used to be that different cultures have different values, and they should all be respected. Now, however, I understand truly what a cop-out that really was. So who holds the moral high ground here? As an ethical relativist, both points of view are perfectly acceptable, but there is value in neither. Only a passive acceptance of everything. No moral high ground, no conflict, nothing worth holding sacred. Sure, I see their point. If I had remained passive myself, if my own passion had not been kindled, I may never have been drawn into the bowels of the Dark Orient. Perhaps Ben would still be with us. Perhaps things might even have turned out better. But how dispassionate an existence without sacred things. Sacred things are the knots in the rope with which the planetary game of tug-of-war gives incentive to keep pulling. Without it, I suspect we'd all just drop the rope and live in relative complacency. There would come of it nothing exceptional. The world would lose its momentum. Eventually, it might stop spinning altogether. If sacred things are a natural force, it would make sense that sometimes they choose us. When Ben's lawyers contacted me with the details of his will, it was a lot to absorb at once. Even for Blarfbat Yongtwaf Esquire, whose precarious cranial hinges betrayed his attempt not to appear dubious, couldn't quite come to terms with it. A Caucasian man, he must be thinking, the new owner of an authentic Chinese restaurant? A place he had no business beyond the counter of to begin with. And now the owner? Truthfully, I was as baffled as he was.
He made these amendments to his will the day before he died,
Yongtwaf told me.
To be completely honest, I was initially suspicious.
I understand, I said.
Of course, you've been cleared of any wrongdoing, and I trust Ben Quach's judgment. He is, of course, a man of good taste.
The Chinese and their puns. I walked out of the lawyer's office with the key to Promiscuous Panda and all the paperwork, everything in my name. It was final. It was the way Ben had wanted it. It felt odd opening Ben's office safe that afternoon. It just hadn't sank in yet that it was now my office safe, and Ben had wanted me to have it. Indeed, he died so that I could have it. Inside, I found recipes. All the recipes to all his mysterious dishes. I was mesmerized. I would spend all night going through them. All the secrets of Chinese cuisine I had ever hoped to learn, and more. On one sheet were the details describing the unusual preparation of shrimp I'd witnessed in the cellar. Reading through it, noting how he had worked the process out on paper like this, I sense a kind of connection with him between our separate planes of existence. With this, I felt a wave of sadness for my old friend, Mike Kiefler, the man who had seen somewhere in me, a Caucasian, the continuation of his sacred tradition. "I won't let you down, Ben," I said aloud. In verification, the cleaver of Hong glowed warmly on the desk. Ben was with me. His entire ancestry was with me, and the gravity of this sacred tradition, forged in the fires of the Taiping Rebellion so long ago, was suddenly so tangible I thought I'd collapse under its weight. But only for a moment. Through the door, I could hear the clanking walks and sizzling grease of the kitchen, the whirring of the slicer nearby, its operator carefully minding the grain. The crinkling of paper bags as my customers leave with their lunches. The sound of the cash register. The cash register. What a sound that was. As if all this isn't enough, I'm actually getting paid for it?
The battle Ben had been entrenched in all these years was clear to me now. This was the secret scourge he had been at odds with, the unethical preparation of food. The object of the Great War so many Chinese had fought and died for. While Ben would have preferred to massage a chicken to death, his counterparts opted to summon demons from the depths to broil them with hellfire. Does it matter either way? By lunchtime, all people are worried about is whether an egg roll was included in the lunch special. Are they good? Are they bad? Or do they do what they do because they're Chinese? Perhaps I can still be a relativist in some matters. Perhaps. But some things are sacred. They must be. Why not hold on to them? To those agents of the status quo, to those hell-bent on harmony, I say keep your unexceptional things. As for me, I carry the cleaver.
And that was The Relativist by Jeff Sturdivant. A good reminder to see what you see and not what they tell you to see. Also, now I'm starving. And don't go too far because in 30 minutes you're going to want to listen to this again. A little about the author. Old Jeffrey is my trusty helper, but he prefers the term executive producer because it makes him feel important. If you'd like to brighten his day, he'd love you to buy his audiobook, Bump. That's B-U-M-P. Bump is about a group of amateur pro wrestlers who become enmeshed in a deadly conspiracy. It sold a whopping 92 copies in 4 years, and that kind of sucks balls. You can link right to it by visiting flexfiction.com. Alternatively, you can not buy it and allow it to continue being Jeff's most abysmal failure. Your call. Thank you, Jeffrey.
And do old Drew Blood a favor, would you? Subscribe to his podcast wherever you do your listening and leave him a 5-star review and a kind word, even if you're listening on YouTube. He needs soldiers on all fronts to win this battle, and he appreciates it. To hear a premium ad-free edition of tonight's and all the other episodes, visit SimplyScaryPodcast.com today and click Patrons in the upper menu. You'll find yourself at ChillingTalesForDarkNights.com, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to their entire audio archive, all ad-free and available to download or stream. Thank you for your time and for supporting our sponsors. When you support our sponsors, you support this show. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all the latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with them each and every week. Oh, and you can find Drew Blood on Facebook and Instagram, and sometimes Twitter. The Drew Blood's Dark Tales podcast is accepting submissions, friend. If you've got a story or two you'd like to be featured on the show, send it to drewbloodhorror@gmail.com. If selected, you'll get the full treatment, 10 bananas.
Well, I'm afraid this is where we part ways, at least till next week. So grab a drink for the road, friend. And if you're one of those airline attendants, mind your safety, or at least keep your ass off my hand. I'm not a piece of meat, you know. So may the wind be at your back, and may the road rise up to meet you. Hey, if you're gonna get your ear pierced, do it with style. Otherwise, go fuck yourself. Oh boy. Good night, y'all.